Good morning. Happy end of first deadline, everybody. And beware the Ides of March. I hope that doesn't like bode poorly for any of our testifiers or presenters today. So we are just short of a quorum, but we will get started with Representative Lean. And House File 2154. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Appreciate you hearing my bill today, House File 2154. And this represents the Gambling Control Board's agency technical bill for the year. It includes five modifications to existing law to help address and improve the regulatory oversight of charitable gambling in Minnesota. The proposed changes allow for conformity with other existing laws and provides further clarification for records to be maintained by licensed charitable gaming organizations. With me today is Tom Barrett, Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board, and he's available to walk through the proposed changes in the bill.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board, and on behalf of the board, I do thank Representative Lean and Madam Chair, you, for allowing our technical bill to get in here on a Friday. Really briefly, we haven't had a technical clarifying bill for a number of years, but we had an unfortunate theft case locally that, you know, you never want to see in the headlines, but there's an embezzlement affecting a bingo operation. And surprisingly, we keep track of every pull tab game, every bingo sheet. What the board does not track individually are gift cards, gift receipts. And that was the catalyst for this recent theft case. And two of the five proposals simply add some clarity in the law that if a charitable organization is going to be involved in offering gift cards, that they got to be sold for face value. They can't be discounted. That was part of the problem with the embezzlement. And simply, they got to keep better records. So that's two of the five. With the opportunity to amend those provisions in law, we also took the opportunity to clarify membership requirements. As you all know, it's tough to get folks to be part of members of non-profit charitable organizations. We're proposing to reduce the membership requirement from 6 months to 90 days. 90 days should be adequate to prove a person's worthiness that they want to become an active member of the organization. Section 2, again, that deals with some of the bingo gift certificates that we're trying to clarify. Section 3 was an oversight that we had. There's limitations involving certain people that cannot participate in charitable gaming. Obviously, a gambling manager cannot, a bar owner cannot, and the immediate family of a bar owner cannot participate for simply the perception that they have inside information. As relates to electronic games, as some of you may be familiar with, you have the opportunity to play electronic pull tabs as well as electronic link bingo. The law is clear that lessors or immediate family members cannot play pull tabs, be it paper or electronic. But because the devices offer the player the opportunity to choose between link bingo and electronic pull tabs, they could theoretically switch, and it's difficult for us to regulate. So the proposed changes simply include electronic link bingo games under the game restrictions for those folks. No known opposition in that respect. Section 4, again, bingo gift card log. Keep track of the gift cards that you have so when our staff go out and do an audit, we can account for them. And then finally, Section 5 modifies the time requirement that charitable organizations need to get the money to the bank. The current law stipulates that they got to have it the day following the end of the month. Obviously, days like New Year's Day and those kinds of things cause little problems, so we're allowing a little more latitude to get the money to the bank, and this, again, is supported by the industry.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Is there anybody else in the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lean, and to the testifier. So just a couple of clarifying questions. I'm assuming, and this is probably an obvious one, but this applies to any charitable organization, whether it would be like a bingo emporium, as well as like a church event, or is that correct?
Mr. Barrett.
Madam Chair and Representative, correct. It would primarily involve all fully licensed nonprofits. Now, in terms of a bingo hall operation, there's only about 12 statewide, so relatively small, but there are opportunities for nonprofits to conduct bingo. And as relates to gift cards, normally we see those at the big operations, so it's relatively small, but it would have impact anybody if they wanted to offer gift cards for bingo.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you. And so can you, just because I'm not familiar, can you explain to me the gift card, and you've got this line on 2.1, gift certificates must be sold at face value. I mean, is there a black market of these things? Are they moving around? And just let me know what's going on with this, because I'm not familiar.
Mr. Barrett.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. No, there's no black market. It's basically, if you were to go into a restaurant or anybody else that offers a gift card, give me a $50 gift card. What we found happening is the person would pay $50, and then the seller would take 10 bucks out, or half of it, and then record it as a $25 gift card that was offered for, they discounted and pocketed the money. So now it's a face value. It's clear you can't discount them for anything. So that was the problem we're having.
Representative Crescia. Oh,
okay, so thank you for that. So just walk me, so identify exactly selling all that. So who, I mean, who was pocketing, who was grabbing the $10? And just walk me through all the players of this. This is interesting.
Yep. Mr. Barrett.
Yep. Madam Chair, and Representative, I can leave you a copy of the news article as well so you get more detail. But it was the seller, an employee of the charity, that was on their own. Actually, there was a bit more collusion. There was a couple other people that were involved. But if you were a player and you came up and I wanted to buy a $25 gift card to give to my wife, friend, whatever, you would pay $25. What the people were doing were recording, you know, a $20 purchase, and they're taking the difference and putting it in their pocket. There's no log, there's no accounting, or lack of accounting in this case.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the indulgence. Okay, so as I understand, so when you say the seller, you're talking the actual person, not the entity. So we had an employee or somebody. That's where the that's where this was going on.
Mr. Barrett.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, it's an employee, but it's an employee of the nonprofit. So all those employees that work for the nonprofit are held accountable as we would with the organization.
Representative Crescia.
And so there was no law for this before? I mean, how?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative. There is law in terms of they need to account for their assets. They need to account for the money. As I said, we monitor every pull tab game, every bingo sheet, and we have that in our inventory that matches up with theirs. We don't have that level of detail when it comes to gift cards. So the simple change is here. You got to sell them for face value so we know what the value is when they redeem them. And you also have to keep a log. So we can look at that log and go, well, when was it sold and when was it redeemed or what's still outstanding?
Representative Crescia.
Thank you. Okay, so now I understand. What you're actually doing is we're adding accountability measures so we can go back to the paper trail. We're not going to actually be able to get to the behavior, but we're now going to be able to see the behavior and uncover it. Is that what this is doing?
Mr. Barrett.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, I guess, yes.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm all for keeping big bingo in check, so where it passes.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Where I come from, big bingo is called blackout.
And my mother's probably there.
I haven't seen her there recently. Madam Chair, to Mr. Barrett, online, kind of on the same idea that Representative Crescia had on 2.4, bingo gift cards must be only sold, and I'm focusing on the word sold. So if I am a bingo nonprofit that's running a bingo location and bingo house, can I give those away as a promotional two-for-one, discounted as a marketing tool to try to attract people to come in, or some kind of a, I use the term Black Friday special kind of a thing that businesses are known to participate in or offer?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative. No, in the case of gift cards, we are asking for strictly to be sold and sold for face value. Mm. What you might be talking about, and there is this opportunity, is nonprofits that conduct bingo can offer coupons. Now, they could be printed in a local paper. When a coupon comes in, a dollar off or $5 off a bingo packet, the law and rule requires the purchaser to sign that particular coupon, so we know it's not coming from internally. But there's another option for a promotional type value to get somebody for Black Friday or whatever you want to call it. But it's different, coupons versus gift cards. With gift cards, it's the cash that we want to make sure they're accountable for.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I'd also like just a little more clarification on Subdivision 5. and that's lines 2.16 through 2.18. The lessor is the immediate family. So my assumption is that if you happen to have, say, a bar restaurant, I'm the owner of that bar restaurant. When I lease to the nonprofit, I'm the lessor, they're the lessee, correct?
Correct, Madam Chair. Representative Barrett.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett, what happens if this is owned by a corporation? Because you talk about the lessor. So I'm just wanting to know where officers stand in that corporation, if we're talking about immediate members of their family. And if it's a family operation, you may have a parent who is an officer. Another might be a manager or other officer. And how far down does that cascade in that type of a relationship?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative, another good question. In the case of a corporate-type entity, we still look to who's signing the lease between who's the lessor, the owner of the corporation, and the charity. So the person that's signing off on the lease is recognized as the lessor for purposes of conduct at that activity.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And, Mr. Barrett, I think this is probably my last question on that. So if you and I were brothers and we owned an entity and you were the president and I was the vice president and I signed the leases on behalf of our corporation, you would be allowed to purchase tabs because you weren't the signatory as the lessor on the lease document?
Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. In your example, we're brothers, and I welcome that opportunity. But
well, thank you. I do, too. Mm-hmm.
If we're brothers, though, because I am a blood brother, immediate family of you, and you sign the lease, I could not. Now, if it was Representative Lean was president and not related, he could play.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, that just gives me pause to go, that's all. I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. Additional member discussion. Seeing none, Representative Lean, last words.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I like the sound of Representative Lean for president, but I'll hold off on that. I appreciate hearing the bill this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lean. With that, we have a couple orders of business because we do have a quorum now, so I will officially move the bill in front of us. So I will move that House File 2154 be re-referred to the General Register. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to the General Register. Thank you. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Mr. Barrett. Okay, so Representative Howard, we're going to take up your bill now. And so I understand that you have an amendment that might be forthcoming at some point.
Yes, Madam Chair. It's deadline week, but we've been working over the last couple days with some of the stakeholders and do have a largely technical amendment that should be arriving soon. We could potentially walk through the bill in broad strokes.
Let's do that, and then we can lay it over and entertain the amendment later in the committee process.
Okay.
So if you want to present your bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Tice.
I just want to thank you and your staff for having a committee meeting where people are smiling and giving us treats and things like that. It means a ton to come here at 9 o'clock in the morning and get a sugar rush. So thank you.
Sugar rush. Well, thank you. Yes. Thanks to Amy.
Coffee too?
And there's always one, right? Yep. Well, welcome to the committee, Mr. Howard. And, of course, you are part of the committee. So you can move your bill in front of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move my bill.
To be re-referred to the General Register.
To be re-referred to the General Register. This is House File 1571, and it deals with our manufactured home communities across the state. And, you know, preserving and improving the condition of our manufactured home communities is a vital and efficient strategy to meet our housing needs of communities across the state. As background, there are roughly 1,000 home parks in Minnesota, however none that are new since the 1990s. We have 50,000 owners of manufactured homes, making it the largest source of affordable home ownership in the state. However, over the past many years, we've seen more and more of our manufactured home parks close for redevelopment. And when those are lost, not only are Minnesotans displaced, we lose that affordable housing forever. And as we know, that's a big crisis we're facing in greater Minnesota, in the metro area, all across the state. Minnesota has a right of first refusal law where we encourage park owners to sell their communities to the homeowners. In Minnesota, if a park community is being sold for redevelopment, residents or an authorized nonprofit are given 45 days to meet the same terms and conditions as the developer. Unfortunately, we've seen that process has presented loopholes and barriers in its application that has worked against homeowners and led to displacement of Minnesotans. In particular, the situation at Lowry Grove, which we'll hear about, it brings us this bill to help us make some changes. But I want to be clear, not wholesale changes to the process. We're looking at closing some loopholes and simplifying the process for homeowners simply so that this law can work as intended. We will have an amendment here, and I apologize, it's not right before us. We've been working fast and furious with the representatives on behalf of the residents and the owners of the home parks to work on some, you know, peace in the valley language, and one, to clarify a definition of resident of the home park, and also to look at some sort of process where there could be some earnest money in place if home park residents were to proceed and move forward, to give some assurances to the manufacturers, the owners of the home parks, if something happens, they get down the road and the kind of the bottom falls out, so to speak. And so I appreciate the work that's been ongoing in the conversations to make changes to the bill to get us closer to agreement, and we can specifically, we can talk about some of those amendments, and hopefully it'll be before us momentarily. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, or APAC. It's an association of manufactured homeowners. Manufactured homes in a manufactured home park can be not just a form of affordable housing, but a path to sustainable home ownership. The average statewide lot rents are half of the average for apartment rents. The cost per square foot to construct a manufactured home is half of what it is to construct a home on site. And new homes that are being produced now are rated as having the same construction quality and longevity as site-built homes. Unfortunately, if you do locate your manufactured home on a lot that you're renting in a park, it does put you in a vulnerable position. When a park is closed, most homes are lost because they can't be moved or there's no place to move them to. Fortunately, as Representative Howard mentioned, Minnesota is one of the 19 states that has a policy that encourages or requires residents to have that opportunity to purchase their park, to have 45 days to match a developer's offer and buy their community. Unfortunately, as the 100 families in Lowry Grove discovered, a park located in the city of St. Anthony, the existing right of first refusal does have some problems built into it. The residents were able, in working with Aon, a nonprofit developer, to offer to meet the terms and conditions in less than 45 days. But unfortunately, some of the problems in the law allowed the landowner to ignore that offer and move forward with the sale to the developer. The law is clear that that's an unlawful act, but one of the problems in the statute is that a remedy can't be to halt an unlawful sale, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. As a result of the Lowry Grove purchase, by the residents not being able to go through, people lost their homes, children were pulled out of high-performing schools, there are some former residents who are currently homeless, and in one case, an individual, Frank Edelman, ended his life, that he just didn't see a way forward with the loss of his home and the amount of compensation that he was getting to start over. So to review what changes are made in the bill, there's an addition to the definition section of 327C, which is the manufactured housing statute, that defines what a resident or a representative acting on behalf of the residents is, and the forthcoming amendment clarifies that further. In subdivision 6, it clarifies some issues that were unclear in the use of the right of first refusal, including when terms and conditions need to be provided immediately, when a purchase agreement can be entered into after the 45 days, what it means to meet the terms and conditions, and it clarifies that it's the material terms and conditions. So, for instance, purchasing the park in order to close it for redevelopment can't be a condition that the residents would be forced to match. It also, in that subdivision, adds language that allows residents to request the notices that are going out about the closure and the opportunity to purchase in alternative formats if they have a disability or in an alternative language. In subdivision 7, it simplifies dramatically that subdivision, which was originally put into law to create essentially a second right of first refusal in the event that the developer failed to disclose their intent to redevelop the community, and instead just requires that the purchaser wait 12 months to issue a closure notice. So there's no second right of first refusal. It's just what's covered in subdivision 6. Subdivision 8 is entirely repealed. It's a strange requirement that a notice be filed with the county indicating that a manufactured home park, which is already licensed with the state, a license that has to be renewed annually to operate as a park, that community also has to file a notice indicating that their licensed park community is operating as a park community. So it's redundant. It's unnecessary. It's not used for any other purpose outside of the statute. Subdivision 9 deals with what ultimately doomed the attempt by the residents to purchase Lowry Grove. What I talked about in terms of not being allowed as a remedy, halting an unlawful sale, and subdivision 11 clarifies what it means or who it is that should be filing an affidavit of compliance. But there's some strange language in there that allows even a, quote, other person with personal knowledge to file an affidavit of compliance with the law, and the bill suggests that should be the bona fide purchaser that does that. In conclusion, the bill doesn't do anything to expand the footprint of the right of first refusal. It just allows it to work as intended. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, a couple of questions to the bill author. Representative Howard, what's the status of this bill? Is there a companion that's moving in the Senate right now?
Representative Howard.
There is a companion in the Senate with bipartisan authorship. I don't know if it has a hearing date as of yet, but bipartisan authorship, and I know some interest to move forward.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, the reason I asked that question is I understand that that nonpartisan staff has been working literally night and day, 24 hours a day, to try to keep up with the amount of amendments and bills and things that have been there. And since we're behind in getting the amendment here, I'm just wondering if the committee is going to have to wait until we get that amendment, possibly recess until we get that amendment, or what the plan is going to be, since we're about ready to maybe take action on this bill. And I guess kind of disingenuous to hold the committee too, if that's what we're waiting on as an amendment at some point this morning as well.
Representative O'Driscoll, I have no intention to hold the committee. There are numerous options. We'll lay it on the table, lay it over once we end our discussion, and we can take it up for further action at the end of our meeting, or we can the author can work on the amendment further and bring it to the floor. So there's lots of options.
I just want to make sure, because as you well know, many members have other committees that they need to be to today as well, and so I just wanted to make sure that we're keeping business moving for the good of the cause.
That is my intention, and that is always my intention. Additional questions, Representative O'Driscoll?
None at this time.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering the path, and is this headed to judiciary civil law at any point? It's sort of bordering on sort of civil dispute. Obviously, it's a civil dispute, but is this going to civil law at all? I don't know if it's changing any, like, right of action or anything like that.
Representative O'Neill, the motion is to send this to the floor. There is nothing in the bill that requires a stop in judiciary civil law.
It just seemed awfully close to that kind of topic, so I'm just wondering to see where it was headed.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, one other quick follow-up.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. The amendment, does it deal with anything that would be in the purview of civil law?
Representative Howard.
I don't believe so. There's clarifying language to be clear about the definition of a resident. And then there's also will be language, as I mentioned, about providing some assurances if the park owners, you know, enter into the process and in the event that it goes south.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are you amending anything further in Section 4, Subdivision 9, which is the effect of noncompliance? So essentially what happens when there is noncompliance? Because you have on line 3.15, it says you have a right to any remedy. And if you go much farther, I think it probably needs to go to civil law.
Just Representative Howard, do you want to answer that question now, or do you want to answer it when we have the amendment in front of us?
There's nothing more dealing with that.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that is the section where the amendment is, but I'd be happy to kind of address that. And I apologize that we don't have it right before us.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a quick
question. Representative O'Neill.
So Representative Lesh, Chair Lesh, is not here, unfortunately, because he just started judiciary civil law. So if you could just check in with him just to have him, because this sounds awfully close. If it's not already in the jurisdiction, it's awfully close. We're talking about civil disputes and remedies. And so I would feel better if you just checked in with him.
I can do that.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. Representative Tate.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howard. We heard this in housing earlier this week, Wednesday, and the changes that Representative Howard is talking about were the issues that were really bothersome to some of our members. Representative Pearson, especially being in real estate, had a lot of questions about definitions, who's an owner, and also regarding earnest money and things such as that. So it really sounds like Representative Howard is addressing exactly the issues that we have, so I'm anxious to see the amendment, and glad that you took those concerns to heart, and we'll see what the amendment is. Thank you.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author. So, okay, that gives a little more context. I didn't realize it had another hearing, and so we're here. Tell me about the amendment process. Tell me what's going on here. I mean, right, and I'm trying to help you here. I'm trying to throw you a lifeline, because right now this looks really uncertain, and this is when people start to really dig deep into things. Tell me why it's late. Tell me why we don't have the amendment in front of us. Was it just because people are busy? Was it late agreements? Tell me what's going on.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, and as Representative Tice mentioned, this bill was heard on Wednesday in housing. And we did hear some feedback from the committee as well as from the manufactured homeowners. And since Wednesday, we've been working on some language to provide clarity based on that discussion.
Representative Crescia.
Madam Chair, okay, so we've made deadlines. So this bill is not dead. So just to, you know, and I'm just throwing this out for you to consider. I mean, we've got, you've already made the deadlines. This thing can continue to move. It sounds like it has some Senate companionship. There's lots of ways to do this right, and just to make sure everyone gets a chance to see the language and know probably the good work that you're doing. So I would just enter that into consideration for you. You know, rather than trying to rush something at us that we're all going to talk negatively about, you know, there's an opportunity to probably do it right on the floor even, and to talk about in front of the whole body about how you have worked with all the parties and you have peace in the valley. Those things slide through much quicker than when people make obfuscating issues out of things that may not exist. So I'm just throwing that out there for you, however you want to do it. I'll respect the committee and the rules of the chair.
Representative Howard, do you want to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha. I appreciate the comments, and I think that ultimately we're talking about the same goal, is making sure that we have a bill that can move forward, that dots all the I's and crosses the T's. And I believe that, you know, we have an opportunity to have a fairly technical amendment come before us, so I guess that'd be my preference, but if it starts to get long in time, I'm open to other options as well. So.
Thank you, Representative Howard. I see that there's somebody from the public who does want to speak to this bill. We will allow that. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota, and I'd like to thank Representative Howard for working with us on amending the bill. Some significant changes were adopted in the Housing Committee. We are still working on language that we haven't seen yet in its entirety that will be a part of the amendment. One of those issues was just raised regarding the definition of a resident or a homeowner, so we're waiting to see as well as whether that's been fully addressed relative to the homeowners only being able to sign the definition or the petition to be represented by a potential purchaser. So we'll probably have more to say once we've had a chance to see the amendment.
Thank you. And the amendment just arrived. So, Representative Howard, with your okay, what I would like to do is to lay this bill over, and we will take it up at the end of the hearing to allow people some time to look at the amendment and process it, all the stakeholders and all the members. So with that, I'm going to lay this bill. This bill is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Representative Elkins has a bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And this Representative Elkins, I think that the engrossment that people have, it has me listed as chief author, but we made a motion yesterday to change the chief authorship to Representative Elkins. So thank you, Representative Elkins, for taking this on. It's a agency bill and deals with some conforming and NAIC language. So welcome to the committee. You can move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that. Well, where is this going next? Just to the register.
General Register, sir.
Move that the House File 2051 be referred to the General Register.
Right. You can proceed with your testimony.
Right. We have two amendments before us as well. Okay. So the first one actually is the A19 Delete All Amendment. Yep. And the second one, the A1 amendment, will follow that one, actually.
Very good. So, Representative Elkins, you move the A19 amendment?
I do.
Representative Elkins moves the A19 author's amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Elkins.
Thank you. I have with me Jonathan Kelly from the Department of Commerce today, and he's going to walk us through these provisions.
And just procedurally, did you want to move the A1 at this time, or did you want, would that get the bill in the shape that the author wants?
Yeah, okay, it would make sense. So I'll move that we approve the A1 amendment as well. The A1 amendment has some additional provisions that will allow Medicare cost plan replacement policies to conform with the federal MACRA bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And I believe Ms. Pompeo has some updates for us. Welcome. Proceed.
Chair and members, just a technical change to the A1 amendment. It's an amendment to the amendment. Yes. So it should read, Representative Elkins moves to amend the delete everything amendment, the A19-0202, to House File 2051, just to make sure that it's clear it's an amendment to the amendment.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, Representative Elkins, do you want to correct your motion?
Move that the A1 amendment to the A19 amendment. Okay.
We adopted the A19 amendment. We adopted it. We adopted the A19 already. Okay, very good. All right. So Representative Elkins moves the A1 amendment to the A19 amendment. Any discussion to that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Your bill is amended.
Madam Chair, members, again for the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2051, which is the Commerce Department's National Association of Insurance Commissioners, NAIC, accreditation bill. The department would like to provide some background on both why the bill is needed and the specific model acts contained in the bill. The department would also like to note that we have been in discussions with both the Insurance Federation of Minnesota and the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council on this bill and are working through making some technical changes that they have requested. These changes will likely be made in the other body next week. Background on this bill as a whole. And the reason that there was a delete all amendment is that this is stitching together several model acts that are required for conformity for the state and the macro conformity. So the NAIC model acts included in this proposal are accreditation standards beginning on January 1st, 2020. NAIC accreditation allows other states to rely on the department's review and examination of domestic insurers, reducing costs and administrative burden for Minnesota insurers. Commerce's insurance division was accredited in 2017 for an additional 5 years by the NAIC. Without action by the legislature in 2019, Minnesota could be at risk for losing accreditation. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners accreditation bill includes the following NAIC model acts and one statute change for federal conformity. The first one is it's Article 4, it's the Corporate Governance Model Act. The Model Act provides the Department of Commerce additional information on corporate governance practices on a yearly basis. Currently, the department receives corporate governance information every 3 to 5 years based on the insurance examination schedule. These models do not prescribe new corporate governance standards, but rather require tailored, confidential reporting to ensure appropriate policies and procedures of insurers, board of directors, and internal oversight are in place and effective. Currently, 27 states have passed legislation to implement the Model Act, with pending legislation in 5 states. The next is revisions to the annual financial reporting model regulation, and I apologize, these are not in order of the bill. The original Model Act was passed in Minnesota in 2009. The revisions to the Model Act requires all large insurers to have internal audit capabilities and have direct access for internal audit committee for the board of directors independent from insurance company management. The Model Act will enhance the department's ability to monitor insurance solvency. Thus, updated Model Act has been adopted by 19 states. The next is revisions to the Model Holding Company Act. This model identifies the lead regulator for an insurance company that operates in at least 3 countries. These insurance companies are referred to as Internationally Active Insurance Groups, IAIGS. The revisions clarify legal authority and the power of a state to act as the group-wide supervisor for an internationally active insurance group, or AIG. Minnesota is only home to 1 insurance company, Allianz, who you can see when you're on 94 on the stadium, that meets this criteria, but their lead regulator is in Germany. This is not proposing that Minnesota become its lead regulator, it's just that we are able to do so if ever needed. This has been adopted in 26 states, and so that is the Model Act portion. The Health RBC Trend Test. This Model Act assists in identifying financially troubled health insurance companies. The RBC trend test is currently in statute for all insurance types except health insurance. This model act has previously passed the House, and it did not make it to the governor's desk. It usually gets amendments, unfriendly amendments added to it, and so we're bringing it back this year. And the Council of Health Plans has supported the passage of this model act in previous years. And then this next piece is the Medicare Supplemental Plan Macroconformity, which was the amendment to the amendment. This proposal ensures that Medicare supplemental plans sold in Minnesota conform to federal requirements. Beginning in 2020, federal law will no longer allow Medicare supplemental plans to cover Part B deductibles. Medicare supplement plans have higher benefits than similar plans in most states. These protections include rates, plan designs, contract standards, and coverage requirements. If Minnesota does not enact this federal conformity proposal, Minnesota seniors will lose guarantee issue protections, particularly if they are disabled or have end-stage renal disease, and lose access to higher quality Medicare supplement products available in the marketplace today. Thank you for your time, and we will remain here for any member questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, members, questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not specifically to the bill, but more to the concept. Are you continuing to work on expediting other NAISC provisions, not just necessarily in the insurance area, but perhaps appraisal, real estate, some of other Minnesota's regulated industries?
Not to the bill, which we do like to keep our discussion of the bill, but please proceed with the question.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I can't speak to the other. We do try to follow the national groups that we, if they have model laws that are needed for conformity, we do try to move in that direction, but it's kind of on a case-by-case basis. Right now, we are trying to get these NAIC accreditations passed so that we can maintain our accreditation for January 1st, 2020.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Representative O'Driscoll.
And that's extremely important because Minnesota's regulated industries do also have interaction with other states, and each state is allowed to have their own regulations for real estate, insurance, and other regulated industries. And it's very important when we're talking about as interconnected as our economy is and our society and culture is, that we have some predictability. And so as I had prefaced my comments, not specific to the bill, but definitely the concept, that I would encourage the department to continue on a fast track and adopting that, because it is going to be extremely important for product providers maybe wanting to come into Minnesota to be able to have a predictable landscape under the NAIC model. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Further member discussion? Seeing none, final word, Representative Elkins.
Pretty straightforward.
All right, pretty straightforward. With that, Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 2051 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you are on your way, sir. Thank you very much. Mr. Kelly gets to stay. Representative Richardson has a bill. House File 1960.
What?
And there are more donuts. Everyone's going to have a nice afternoon nap. Ms. Representative Tice.
Madam Chair, last time he presented, we weren't sure if it was his first time or not, so this is guilt donut.
Very Minnesotan donuts. Excellent.
From Shakopee, nonetheless.
From Shakopee. Representative Richardson, before we go any more off the rails, you better get us back on track. And there's more sugar.
I mean.
Would you like to move your bill, Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Richardson, we're gonna move a bill, folks. Representative, stick with me. We got one more. Representative Richardson moves House File 1960 to the General Register. I don't believe I see an amendment, Representative.
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, very good. To your bill, Representative Richardson.
So So House File 1960 is a housekeeping bill with the Commerce Department, and it relates to some technical changes related to enforcement, administrative services, and financial institutions. And I have a testifier to speak to those changes.
Very good. Welcome back. You can restate your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, for the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of our housekeeping and technical change bill. This bill makes technical changes, it fixes incorrect cross-references, and makes statutory license requirements uniform. And proposals include the following. In the enforcement division, it would be changing debt settlement housekeeping. So this would, in Chapter 332B, it would bring it into alignment with other licenses in the department. Almost every other license in the department, whether you're a real estate agent or insurance agent, if there's any changes, you have to notify the department within 10 days. For whatever reason, in 332B, it was 90 days. So we're just correcting a 90 to 10. And the last, it also would be add a clarifying cross-reference to 332.37, which is just pointing out that there is a statute of limitations of 6 years for debt collection. In administrative services, this is just kind of a good government cleanup here. Currently, to be a Petro Fund contractor, you have to register with the department every year. We're pushing that out to 2 years. It makes it easier for the contractors to just focus on remediation and other projects and not have to deal with paperwork with the department, and it also reduces our staff time. There is no fee to register, so there's no fiscal impact. The other one is a licensing technical change. When we adopted NAIC accreditation for independent and public adjuster licensing model language, two standards for reporting were inadvertently left in the statute. This proposal requires the adjuster to inform the commissioner of any change in legal name, resident, or business address within 10 days of the change, and the proposal updates an incorrect cross-reference in Minnesota Statute 82B. So there were kind of two requirements that they were different. We're just making one requirement. And lastly, there are some changes that would affect the Financial Institutions Division of the department. The first is a mortgage originator transitional licensing federal conformity piece. This would allow mortgage originators to obtain temporary loan origination authority if they change institutions or move interstate while their new license application is awaiting approval by Commerce. So if someone was a mortgage originator in another state and moved to Minnesota or they changed firms, they're not stuck in limbo. And this is this exemption is ordered to confirm with recent changes to the Dodd-Frank Act. The next would be a Safe Seniors Financial Protection Act clarification. So the House and Senate last year passed the same Safe Seniors Financial Protection Act that allows for broker dealers and advisors to report instances of senior financial exploitation. But this would just clarify the Protection Act applies to Federal Securities Exchange Commission registered investment advisors. The current law does not specify that SEC registered investment advisors are eligible to receive the immunity provisions under the Safe Senior Financial Protection Act. And lastly, there is a securities public records confidentiality update that corrects an inaccuracy that excludes data from audits and inspections of registered securities firm records as non-public and confidential. A correction is needed to the citation. And for that, I'll stand for member questions.
Thank you. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, members, questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a dream come true for me. This is the area that I practice in, so I'm very excited to have the opportunity to get into the details on a wonky bill with the department this morning. To the testifier, let's just start on page 2. The added language in subdivision 6, 2.1 through 2.13. I understand where you're going with this, and you're talking about somebody who's licensed as a mortgage loan originator in the state of Minnesota would also have to have their national registration as a loan originator. So are you talking about you will be granted the authority to be able to, if they move from one Minnesota lender to another, like a real estate salesperson would move from one real estate broker to another, be able to expedite that transfer.
Mr. Kelly?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes. The goal is to, if you change jobs and you're waiting for your authority to catch up with you, if it's being, it's usually held by the employer, that it's going to be, you're going to be able to, start working. Or if you come from another state, you'd also that, you know, you'd be able to have a temporary authority from the department to do your job.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier from the department, what's your process going to be for that? I mean, I know that you're talking about having authority makes good sense. I'm just looking at what the steps are. For example, in Chapter 82, when we're doing that with real estate folks, there's a form, there's a process, there's signatures that are on there, or one would give up the adequate responsibilities and supervisory requirements, and another would pick it up, and so you'd have a document trail as to when that would happen. I don't believe that's within the department's rulemaking provisions. I'm just wondering how the statutory proposed change would deal with that.
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, great question. I will check in with our Financial Institutions Division folks and send you a follow-up directly.
Madam Chair, I just don't want to have a problem with the intent is great. I'm all behind it. I just don't want us to have something in the statute that they can't actually use after the bill is passed and signed by the governor. I want them to be able to have worked that process through, and that's not really within rulemaking. That is definitely something that need statutory authority on that for them to be able to paper trail that. And then one other question, page 7, and it's in section H, which is 7.8 through 7.16. Run by me one more time what's happening in that section. It went kind of quick for me.
Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, let me just make sure that I'm... So this is right now Petrofund contractors, so contractors that do the remediation work for contaminated soil. They are required to register annually with the department. We are pushing that to 2 years so that they don't have to come back every year and do this. They're still having to register. It's just making it a 2-year period rather than an annual period.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the question I guess I have to follow up on that, and again, I know what you're doing, I think it's a great idea, so I'll make sure that we've 360'd some of the other issues from other regulated industries in Minnesota. When we moved to Minnesota from an annual licensing in other areas to a biannual license on that, what we ended up with is a situation where licenses would expire, not all, or authorities would expire all in the same time. So all you're doing is moving it from the workload from 1 year to 2 years. Have you looked at a staggered renewal on that to be able to help with your workflow in the department and to be able to do proper follow-up and investigation if necessary on potential extension or granting of licenses?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, again, great question. I will follow up with our Petrofund folks and get back to you directly.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Like I say, this is just Tim O'Driscoll. I'm loving every minute of this morning. So, thank you. But one last question for the testifier, and that is, do those have a set in statute expiration date, or are they as applied in a 12-month rolling period? Thus, the 24 of the statute is adopted.
Mr. Kelly.
Well, my plan of coming up here to look like I knew what I was talking about is shot. But I will say, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I will check that. I'm not sure, and I don't want to speculate onto how it's structured, whether it's if it's from when it's where the registration is given or if it's calendar year. I will let you know.
And again, Madam Chair, and to the department, this is not stump the department. Hey, this is just my experience with 25 years in regulated industries in the state of Minnesota. Just wanted to make sure it's predictable for you, enforceable for you, as well as understood, and that the persons and parties regulated would be. My last question, is there anything at all in here about fiduciary duties?
Representative
Stevenson didn't catch that. That's fine.
Oh. A rhetorical question, it sounds like. Thank you very much. Thank you for the discussion, Representative O'Driscoll. Additional member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Richardson, any final words?
No, just would ask for support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. With that, Representative Richardson renews her motion that House File 1960 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way, Representative. Thank you very much. We will take House File 1571 back up. The amendment was distributed to members. And Representative Howard, do you want to bring the parties down to discuss the amendment? Welcome back, sir.
Madam Chair, glad to be back with the amendment. It does represent the product of the collaboration between the stakeholders, and would be happy to answer any questions. And just per I do want to, I think Representative O'Driscoll mentioned our staff that is working around the clock, and I just want to publicly thank them for doing just that. It's quite a lot of work under the gun, and I really appreciate it very much. And I'm glad that we have an amendment here that represents the work of the stakeholders of the last couple of days.
Good. Would the stakeholders like to speak to this amendment?
Sure.
You just reintroduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Again, like to thank Representative Howard for his work and trying to tighten things up. And we did have a brief conversation about the amendment, and he has told us that we'll continue to work. You know, the change being made. Inserting the word resident, we need to look at, from our perspective, that definition includes or would allow minors who are living in a home. We want to, you know, make sure that that's not the case, and if so, we'd want to work further to tighten that up so that minor children can't be signing documents to allow someone to attempt to purchase a property. But otherwise, you know, that change would be acceptable if that's not the case.
Representative Howard?
Madam Chair, and open to that, I think we have, as Representative Kreisha had mentioned, we do have that opportunity on the floor, and so if there's a need for even further clarifying language, I'd very much want to do that.
Madam Chair. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier's comments, do we allow minors to enter into contracts in the state of Minnesota?
Representative, anybody want to take that? Ms. Pompeo, I'm glad we were here.
Chair and members, contracts under the age of 18, from 16 to 18, are allowed, but they're usually voidable on the choice of the minor, so it's not common, no.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pompeo. There are occasions, and it's avoidable. Okay, thank you.
I appreciate that clarification because that question popped into my head as well. It sounds like it'll take a level of detail to deal with. Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make, there's one space missing on line 1.11 on the word 10%. I would just make that one very small change to add a space for in the word 10%.
Oh. Very good. Is that an incorporation that can be made without an amendment or without a motion? We will incorporate that change. Thank you. Good catch.
All right.
Any other discussion from the testifiers to the motion or to the amendment?
Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Anderson. I'm with All Parks Alliance for Change, and we're supportive of the proposed amendment language and thankful for the work of Representative Howard.
Thank you. And would you say that you are still going to work with the other stakeholders regarding that small clarification about minors signing contracts?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else from the audience who wishes to testify? Seeing none, members, questions? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howard. Thank you for the amendments. It pretty much hits a lot of what we talked about in housing, and I'm really appreciative to have it here. We did hear testimony from, was it Antonio, which was basically being a resident there and some of the things that happened, and it was very sad to see that a gentleman had a sign outside, you know, save the park, and he didn't move. And it was really, really sad. But it is, I've been on both sides of this with the city of Wade Park. They had a park that closed, and it was quite an ordeal to get everybody transferred. So it's really, I appreciate your work on this. I'm really glad that the amendment is here and we're feeling a little bit better about it and that you'll continue to work with it. As far as minors, when my sons bought a house, our younger one was 17 when they had the purchase agreement. And so, of course, we were co-signers, but we had to be co-signers anyway because of their age. So I wonder if that isn't going to be required, as to having somebody not 18 and older co-sign on the loan. So, I mean, that was my experience. It was a bit ago, but as long as mom and dad were there or someone, they would allow him to buy the home. When he bought the home, he was 18, but the purchase agreement was done when he was 17. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howard. When I look at the A4 amendment and I look at lines 120 through 122, I'm curious about this because as I read it, it almost seems like it's a clause that makes it so that the representative acting on behalf of the residents, so ultimately the residents, aren't able to quickly benefit financially. In other words, if they do this, they have to hold it for 10 years before they can enter into another type of transaction or another type of sale. Was that sort of the intent of this, or am I reading into something that's not there?
Representative Howard, or? Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative, from the perspective of the Homeowners Association, it's a protection against the residents being misused by a straw buyer who may just be trying to use the statute to do an end run around arrival. That this just ensures that the representative acting on behalf of the residents is acting in good faith and that the community will be preserved. Thank you.
Representative Dean. Nope. Thank you very much. Other member questions? Seeing none, last word, Representative Howard, and then we have a couple motions to make. So,
Madam Chair and members, thanks for the flexibility this morning. As we heard some of the stories about what can happen, this really is an important bill, and I look forward to moving it forward and with the collaboration of stakeholders to make a difference for our residents in our manufactured home parks in communities all across the state.
Thank you, Representative Howard. And the motions that we will need will be a motion to move your bill once again, so if you could do that.
We've got the A4 amendment, right.
Yeah.
So
move your bill.
Move the bill to the general register.
And then you need to move your amendment.
And Madam Chair, I move the A4 amendment.
And Representative Howard moves the A4 amendment. Any further discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 1571, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Any discussion to that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way. Thank you all for your work on this. Members, we just have another piece of official business today, and that is our minutes. Can I get a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Katiza Watoon moves the minutes from March 13th. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, maybe you were going to get to my question, and that's just, do we have a game plan for next week or what we might be looking at as members for Commerce?
Representative O'Driscoll, Tuesday's hearing is posted, and so when we get when the Senate finishes their business for the day, we'll have further postings.
I could see that, Madam Chair. Thank you. And again, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. With that, members, you heard what I was going to say. Tuesday's posted. We'll be back here on Tuesday. In the meantime, I hope everybody has a great weekend where you get to catch up with family and friends and loved ones and naps. We are adjourned.